Welcome to yet another exciting season of Sisters in Conversation, the podcast. I'm your host, Tebelo Motsane. I'm an attorney by profession and the founder of a platform called Sister in Law, which is a platform dedicated to empowering women through legal education. On this podcast, I profile women of color in the legal profession in an attempt to celebrate their contribution to the profession. We journey through their individual stories of perseverance and resilience and overcoming challenges like imposter syndrome, racism, and sexism, to name a few. I hope you're geared up for what promises to be another insightful, informative, and empowering season. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen to this podcast. Welcome to another episode of Sisters in Conversation. I'm your host, Tebelo Motsane. I'm an attorney by profession and the founder of a platform called Sister in Law, which is a platform dedicated to empowering women through legal education. On today's episode, I'm joined by Letlhogonolo Mogorane. Letlhogonolo is a practicing advocate and also a part-time in counsel at the Center for Applied Legal Studies at the University of the Witwatersrand. They are also a commissioner for the O'Neill Lancelot Commission on Racism, Structural Discrimination, and Global Health. They obtained their LLB from Stellenbosch University. After university, they served articles and later became an associate at Bowman Attorneys. In July 2016, they served as a law clerk for Justice Mbuyiseli Madlanga at the Constitutional Court of South Africa. They obtained the Sonke/UCLA Health and Human Rights Fellowship in 2017 and completed a master's in law, specializing in public interest law and policy and critical race studies, summa cum laude. In 2017, they started a literary podcast, The Cheeky Natives, which primarily focuses on the review, curatorship, and archiving of Black literature. The podcast has seen the likes of Professor Kimberly Crenshaw, Mona Elthaway, Dr. Kaling Mufokeng, Darnell L. Moore, Robert Jones Jr., and many more. They were named one of the top 200 young South Africans in 2018. In 2022, they formed part of the judging panel for the Aiko Kane Prize for African Writing. They have worked on a number of constitutional cases. This includes an amicus intervention at the Constitutional Court, arguing cost orders against victims and survivors of gender-based violence, contributing to a culture of silence. They have also worked on matters before the Western Cape High Court and the Malawi Constitutional Court, dealing with survivors' rights to freedom of expression and the criminalization of consensual sex between minors, respectively. Woo! Letlhogonolo, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's such a wonderful, I love your podcast. So like, I'm quite honored to be a guest on your podcast.
Thank you. Thank you so much for making the time to be with us and to share your story. What a colorful bio. Like I was just going through it and I was trying to catch my breath. I did explain off air that I've actually lost my voice. No. Excuse me. So I think, Letlhogonolo, like I do with all my guests on the show, firstly, thank you, like I said, for making time to be with us and to share your story with us today. But let's hear a little bit about who Letlhogonolo is. Can you take us to the beginning? Where were you born and raised? What was your family structure like? Were you raised by, you know, your parents or grandparents or an aunt who stepped in? And where did your early schooling life start?
Okay, so I was raised in Kimberley in the Northern Cape. People call it the Diamond City. Yeah. I was raised by a single mom. So my mom was a single parent. I don't know my dad. Mm-hmm. And then I think when I started kind of towards the end of primary school, which the primary school I attended was Olympic Primary School. I think it's still around, like it's like a very underrated primary school, but a lot of people who've gone on to do like wonderful things were from that primary school. Kind of off the top of my head, I'm thinking about Juanita Kumalo, who is a fitness instructor extraordinaire. And I'll think maybe throughout the conversation about some people who've also been there. And then in grade 7-ish, I went to live with my grandmother, my mom's mom. And I lived with her until I was in grade 11, because she sadly passed away when I was in grade 11. And then I went to move and live with my mom's younger sister from grade 11, I suppose, until I kind of finished university. I lost her the first year that I started working. So the first year I did my article, she sadly passed away. So I suppose in truth, I was raised by three women. I was raised by my mom, I was raised by my grandmother, and I was raised then by my aunt. And those are the three women who kind of, you know, sadly I've lost all of them now. They've all since passed away. But that's essentially where I am. The high school that I went to is called Northern Cape High School, or worse, School Noordkaap, which is kind of a bilingual high school, but primarily Afrikaans. So that's kind of my younger years.
Sure, but that's the village they're talking about. You know, when we often hear that it takes a village, they really just mean, you know, a village of women stepping in, or a village of relatives stepping in and helping, and, you know, helping your single mom, for example, to raise you. So I absolutely love that.
Yeah.
Sure. And then when did you decide that you wanted to study law? Was there like a defining moment? Were you watching something on TV? You know, had you seen a neighbor drive past, or you saw someone at court? Like, what made you decide that this is something you want to pursue, and where did you study?
It's also really interesting, that question, because when I applied to the Constitutional Court, in my cover letter, I explained what living in a community that I grew up in, which was a township kind of riddled with crime, I actually wanted to be a police officer, because I felt, you know, I needed to protect these women that have raised me, right? But we know the kind of situation in South Africa in relation to police, right? And we were severely disappointed that every time you call the police van, even when I was growing up, it didn't show up. So I was like, I don't think this is something that I want to necessarily be a part of, you know, a system that I want to be a part of. So I did public speaking and debating in high school. You know, have gone to international and national competitions when I was in high school, gotten, you know, colors and all of that jazz for those things. And I thought, kind of like, you know, I was a pretty good person with math. And so initially I was like, oh, I should study actuarial science, right? Or I should study like economics. But then I thought, oh my gosh, like, what if I get bored of all these numbers and all these graphs and thinking, right? So maybe let me do something that may, some aspects may be boring, but it will always titillate me. And I thought, okay, let's try law. And so I applied to law school at the University of Cape Town. I think I didn't apply to Rhodes University. I think I applied to UCT, and I applied to Stellenbosch. And Stellenbosch used to run this program called, it was a recruitment process. Obviously, we know, like, in the early like 2010s, right? There weren't a lot of Black people who were at Stellenbosch. So they ran this recruitment drive where they gave top students from around the country who had applied to Stellenbosch kind of a bursary, in order for them to come to the university. So kind of like a top, I think it was 7 or 8, maybe 10 students who had applied to Stellenbosch went on this like week-long seeing the campus, speaking to people, you know, kind of a sales pitch type of thing. And at the end of that, you know, the person who had invited us there kind of said, okay, we'll be offering 30,000 rand to anyone who comes to the university. And growing up with a single parent who was unemployed, it meant that I didn't have, like, you know, a trust fund or wealth of money in order for me to get to university. So that 30,000 rand sounded really appealing, right? And also, ironically, I wanted to be as far away from Kimberley as possible, so Stellenbosch was perfect. And so I started my undergrad degree at Stellenbosch in 2010. So that's where I studied my LLB.
And how was that transition for you? I mean, you know, from a township with obviously predominantly Black people, Black and maybe colored, to now Stellenbosch, like Kore of all, you know, universities, to now Stellenbosch, where it's predominantly, you know, white students, and I can imagine also predominantly white lecturers, probably even white male lecturers. How was that transition for you?
So it's interesting because as I told you, I went to a predominantly Afrikaans high school. So that was mainly white people. So it wasn't a different thing. It was just feeling like continuation of high school in many respects. So I often say to people when people ask me, like, how was Stellenbosch? I say, for me, I speak fluent Afrikaans and I went to an Afrikaans high school. It was kind of a continuation of that. So I had a better time than most people just because I was able to, you know, tell people off in Afrikaans. But you are right. I think it was jarring to think, like, in the years that I was at Stellenbosch, that I had one lecturer in first year who is one lecturer in first year who was colored. And then I had another lecturer in second year who kind of gave a segment of the class who was also colored. And then in my final year, I had one other lecturer. And those were like throughout my LLB curriculum, I only had three essentially colored people teach me and not anyone of like African, if we can call it Black African, so to say. But it was a decent time. I mean, I often tell the story that I think when I was in my graduating class, there were four Black people at Stellenbosch who graduated with us. So it was interesting times. It was really interesting times.
Sure. I think I'm going to prematurely be asking this question, but one of the questions I had for you was also, what does a transformed legal profession look like for you? And I think already we're on the topic of, you know, four Black students, three colored lecturers. What does representation mean to you, and what does a transformed legal profession, or even a university such as Stellenbosch, what does it look like to you?
I mean, I suppose the kind of topic that we've been speaking, thinking about the kind of background and history that we come from, a transformed legal background would look like kind of having more Black people in spaces that where they weren't formerly there. But I think often our idea of transformation is limited to kind of Blackness and womanness in some respects, and not to say that that is a bad thing, because yes, it is true, like it's only been 100 years since the first Black woman attorney, right? 100 years is too small, right? It's only been another maybe 100 or so years since the Black person entered either the attorney's profession or the advocate's profession, and so it is still important to see that, like, more and more Black people want to enter the profession, right? And so the representational in a race perspective in a country such as South Africa is important, and the representation of women, but particularly Black women in a country such as South Africa in a male-dominated kind of profession, that's important. But I suppose for me, my thing is, I think that when we go to Stellenbosch, I was there in March of this year teaching, and there were more Black people in the room than, you know, for instance, 10 years ago, right? And that's good. But for me, I think a transformed legal profession, to answer you straightly, is a legal profession where we all have space, right? I mean, you read my bio, and I'm supposing a lot of people would want to know why you're referring to they, right, instead of the pronouns that people know. I'm a non-binary person, so I'm a trans non-binary person, and my pronouns are they and them. And for me, part of a diverse legal transformative profession is to give space for people like us, right? I mean, it's jumping the gun, but I want to tell you two stories, right? So the first story, I think I was in my second year of practice, which I think was last year. So I'll tell both stories happened last year, actually. So the first one, we had this unopposed role in the Joburg High Court, right? And how the judge sought to separate the role, and this was for COVID restrictions, was to separate it by people's assigned sex at birth, right? Yeah. So female practitioners would go first and then male practitioners would go second, right? And so I rushed there and I just waited until the end of the roll. because I wasn't catered for in how the role was perceived,
Sure.
right?
Sure.
And I stood up when everyone left and I said, this is my matter. And after that, the judge was like, can you please come to my chamber? I went to the judge's chamber afterwards, and the judge asked me if the way that he had designated his role was a problem for me. And I was like, yes, because I don't identify as a female and I don't identify as a male. And so there was no space for me as this type of practitioner. And subsequent to that, we had a conversation and he was like, okay, how do we ameliorate this, right? And I was like, well, you say non-binary people or gender non-conforming persons. And that was kind of how it began. And then another thing that happened is I was arguing one of the cases that you were talking about, which was essentially about a woman's right of freedom of expression in relation to a kind of harassment claim. We can call it kind of almost a defamation claim. I was appearing in the appeal court in Cape Town, and I told my attorneys, who at the time, before I joined the Center for Applied Legal Studies as in-house counsel, they had briefed me. And I said to them, please, can we send an email to the judges to let them know that my prefix is MX or Mix, if you want to say. I even sent them like a video of how to pronounce MX or Mix, and that my pronouns are there and them. And that was sent. We were introduced to the judges. The judges were like, oh my gosh, we got your email. Thank you. One of the judges even said, my daughter told me that in 1920, there was the first time singular then them that were used. And they said, you know, thank you for bringing this to our attention, because you want to be concerned with your client's argument as opposed to being misgendered, right? And so they were also kind enough to be like, if we are to misgender you, please correct us, right? Because we're learning. But I will tell you that they didn't misgender me. They actually took a moment when they were about to say, wait, we're dealing with this. And they're like, yes, MX. And that was deeply profound for me. To know that like my humanity can be affirmed in that way. I suppose another story is I presented about, I suppose, gender and gender diversity in the legal profession at the, you know, the Family Law Conference, which is the clerks by the clerks attorneys. And I presented there, and I didn't know, but there were quite a number of judges that were in attendance. And subsequent to the conference ending, one of the judges kind of put in her directives that, you know, everyone, firstly, like if you're non-binary, what are your pronouns? And then extended it to everyone. Please come and tell us what your pronouns are. And that was profound for me, because it was a conversation about like, pronouns are not only for trans people, they're for everyone. We can't make an assumption by the way that you look, that you are, this is a pronoun. Because often people think pronoun is about gender identity. And while a part of it is about gender identity, it's also gender expression. Maybe you do identify as a woman, but he sounds better for you, right? And so for me, I suppose, to answer your question in a kind of long-winded way, is to say that a diverse legal profession is a space that is created for all of us.
Sure. Yeah, no, thank you. Thank you for those like real living examples. That's exactly how I wanted my question to be answered. So thank you. especially because I was like, okay, I know I'm bringing this prematurely. We haven't even had a conversation, but the conversation is actually built from your lived experiences. So thank you. I think one of the questions I also wanted to ask is that, do you find that people are just unwilling to learn, or is it an ignorance thing, or people just don't know any better? But I think you also just answered by saying that the reception you've received has actually been forthcoming.
I mean, it's interesting that you say that, because while there are people who are willing to learn and people who are open, there are people who I feel have not worked with me because I'm too complicated, you know. I'm bringing this they and them pronouns, like there's just a lot, right? So I do think that there are other people who are quite rigid and binary. And I do think that there are people who are willing to learn. But I mean, I I often say I don't think it's surprising because these people are still people who believe that Black people are not supposed to be legal professionals or that women can only do certain types of work, right? So imagine telling them that you're not any of these things and you are a completely different thing, right? And that the way that they've conceptualized gender is binary. And even the way that they've conceptualized sex and conflated the two is wrong. Like, those people are struggling with race issues and kind of broader women equality issues. You want to bring a whole new gender diversity talk? No, you're lying. So for me, I think that it's been, there've been a lot of people who've been receptive, but it's also been challenging in a sense that like, I still get misgendered, right? I'll tell you a really interesting story. Often I get misgendered in court by, and primarily it's been by Black women judges. They often say, yes, Ms. Mokhwani, yes, what are your submissions? She said this. And that's fascinating for me, right? Because it makes us think about like kind of literally the point of transness in a broad sense, right? That like gender is really, really a social construct because these people are so used to seeing people assigned female at birth, having long hair, nail polish, all of that, right? And so because I have these dreadlocks, they've assigned that to me, that I must be female, right? And therefore a miss, right? And I want to start kind of this practice in my practice note to start putting my pronouns in my prefix, just and see how it goes. But it's been interesting that I've been misgendered quite a bit by Black women judges, and also actually by also white male judges. You know. So it's been fascinating to know like the misgendering is not what you would expect, right? So I'm being feminized in an interesting way, right? And for me, that always makes me think about like how like I'm not close enough to womanhood, but I'm also not close enough to manhood. So I'm oscillating between this weird space where like when people want to address me in a derogatory way, they will remind me that I am not female, right? But in the same token, people will remind me that I am not male because of how I sound, how I look, right? And so that's been quite interesting for me to think about, like, but that's the whole point, right? Like this gender is a construct that like, it doesn't matter how I look. For you, you've perceived that people who sound a particular way are supposed to be this, right? So it's been interesting to kind of see the misgendering and also kind of the taking away of masculinity and the taking away of femininity.
But I mean, just with everything that you're saying, I think the question that's sort of looming somewhere in the distance is, isn't all of this exhausting, like having to teach people how to address you, having to correct, like you have a whole day of like legal stuff going on, which is already a fight on its own. And then still on top of that, have to be fighting with people about like misgendering you. Don't you just get home and you're like, ooh, that was exhausting.
Initially, can I tell you like maybe a year, 2 years ago, it was exhausting because I would fight every single person. Like, you know, it was like, these people are going to the core of my humanity and like, they just don't see me. Now what I do is like, oh, you know, okay, so they've misgendered me. That's fine. The people who care about me and love me know what my pronouns are and they will respect that. Yes, you are right. It does get exhausting. And I think because it does get exhausting, what I have done is it's like water off a duck's back. I'm like, there are people who will learn. But what's been fascinating, Tebello, is this. It's like encountering people like you and you being aggrieved by hearing what's happening to me, right? So you're getting angry, even in a social setting, and you're like, no, but it's not like that. And then I'm like, oh, they get it, right? She gets it because it's like, now I don't need to fight for myself because I have allies and I have people. I don't want to say allies, but I have co-conspirators. You are committing this crime with me, right? You're being deviant with me, if we are to put it that way. And so you're the one who's like, nah, man, this is wrong. Like, this person has just told you who they are, and you are constantly. So before, it used to be tiring. Now it's like, actually, you know what? I may never encounter this person again. And so I don't need to educate them. And actually, I need to preserve my own mental health and well-being and be like, the people who care about me will respect me and my pronouns and my humanity. And those who don't, well, that's okay.
Sure. I think I really just wanna thank you again because when I first asked you to please be a guest on the podcast, I remember you were like, yeah, but it's a women's thing and whatever. And I was like, I know it's a little bit corny that I'm now profiling you during Pride Month, but it is important for us to have these conversations. And the only way we're going to continue teaching people is by having these kind of conversations on a platform like this, you know, a credible platform that I've built to empower the underrepresented in the legal profession. And if we're going to speak about underrepresentation of Black women, then we also need to speak about underrepresentation of queer people, Black queer people, which is equally important because discrimination is discrimination at the end of the day.
I mean, I think you're completely right by saying discrimination is discrimination at the end of the day. I love what Audre Lorde says. Audre Lorde likes to say there's no hierarchy of oppression, right? And I love that because it says that, like, while you think your issue is more important than mine, if they come for you, they're certainly going to come for me. Or if they come for me, they're certainly going to come for you, right? We've seen kind of in the, let's think about it in the broader legal framework, right? We've seen a lot of anti-LGBTI legislation emanating from the United States, but also most recently, the passing of the Anti-Homosexuality Act in Uganda. And while, yes, it affects queer people directly, trust that sexual and reproductive rights are coming on next, right? Trust that when they come for us, like, women's rights, sexual reproductive rights are definitely coming on next. So you are right about discrimination being discrimination. But you know what was interesting about kind of our conversation in relation to but it's a women's podcast. It's also to say that while I'm a non-binary person and I identify as a trans radical feminist, I also understand that certain spaces are created for certain people to elevate, to celebrate, to commune, right? So I'm not the type of person to be like, yeah, but like, yeah, little, now we want to be squeezing in, but to be squeezing. No, it's to say I recognize the importance of wanting to sit down and speak to Black women in the profession and celebrate Black women in the profession. And I don't want to taint that, right? I respect that. And so for me, saying that to you was effectively to say to you, I respect this podcast. And I don't want it to be oh, Lekhokonolo now thinks they're a woman, because I'm not, right? As I said, I'm a trans non-binary person. But I love the fact that you came back and you said, but it's Pride Month, you know, and we also kind of need to, as you say, social spotlight kind of people pushed to the margins in kind of the legal profession. So I'm honored that, like, you know, I get to have the con this conversation. But yeah, I wanted to let you know that, like, I wasn't saying this in a bad way, but I was just saying, like, I'm honoring the work that you're doing, and
Thank
I
you.
don't want to feel like I'm tainting it in any way.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I mean, you touched on Uganda and also just from your bio, I saw that you did some work in Malawi. And I just wanted to say, being in other countries where basically it's a crime to be anything other than she or he, you think that, you know, in South Africa we are progressive. And what kind of work or conversations would you like seeing being done or hosted, you know, beyond Pride Month, especially where it can be almost targeted at empowering or educating our neighboring countries?
You know, what's been interesting about that is to say that we firstly need to kind of speak about the idea that like homosexuality is African. There's this notion that it's like a Western import, right? But to think about like pre-colonial Africa, not to romanticize it, but to think about like our kind of romantic inclination or sexual inclination wasn't necessarily termed with anything. People were having love and sex with whoever they wanted to have. I'm not saying we were romanticizing, say, oh, it was a ball of like gays and all of that. But I'm saying even those labels do not exist then because it wasn't important for people to know, oh, if you're this, you're this, right? So the conversation is really deeply to kind of strip itself from this kind of Western import that people say it is, because it's not a Western import. What is actually a Western import is the bringing of religion. And by bringing the religion, that religion has influenced how we think about homosexuality. Because when you think about all of the African states that have been colonized, you think about the penal code. The penal code does come from a colonial state, right? And that's influenced by some kind of religious inclination. And so for me, I think what we should begin to do is have conversations societally about like kind of the place of religion, the place of culture, the place of tradition. And what does that mean? Because we know that it's not stagnant, it's ever evolving. And so why can't it evolve to include people like me, right? Because the Ugandans who are queer are still Ugandans. And so for people to say, oh no, we want to show the world that Uganda doesn't believe, they're still there. Like they didn't get this from the television or from Europe. Like some of them live in rural Uganda. They've never encountered the West, but they are queer. And what do we say to them? We say to them, oh, it's a Western import. And so when you think about kind of also the case that it was in Malawi is to think about like even the penal code there was criminalizing adolescent sex, right? And so to think about like, we need to also think differently about like, whether we like it or not, teenagers are having sex. Yeah. How do we make sure that they're having safer sex? Mm. How do we make sure that they are protecting themselves against all forms of things, right? And so for me, it's like, if we let our guard down, that we don't think of South Africa as like the America of the of Africa, but we think of South Africa as like, oh, wow, like they've come from far. Let's see what we can learn from them. Then we can begin to have really profound legal developments.
Sure, that is so, so important. Every time I ask something, you really give me more than I bargained for. Thank you so much. I'm also just looking at the time. There were two things that I wanted to touch on, but one of them has now escaped me. But in the meantime, is there anything that I haven't specifically asked you that you would like to, you know, touch on, educate us on, anything at all that I haven't asked you, but it was playing in your mind and you were like, this is something that I really want to mention?
I mean, it's my podcast. My good friend and I, Dr. Amanile Setrele, started a podcast that's called The Cheeky Natives, which is essentially a podcast about the archiving, curating, and sort of spotlighting of Black writers in Africa and in the diaspora. And it's really cool. Like, it's a really cool podcast. I love reading and geeking over books. So anyone who's listening who wants to check out and, you know, find more of a personality outside of the law, I think the podcast is a really wonderful place to start. Yeah, because I love reading and I think reading is important in reading Black writers, Black queer writers. So that's what I think, I suppose, I wanted to mention. That I run a really cool podcast and I hope people can listen to it.
Okay, wonderful. Actually, please share the link with me and then I'll also just put the link on just after your bio. I'm actually going to listen to an episode myself after having this conversation with you. So thank you for mentioning that. Oh my goodness. Okay, Lekanolo, just looking at the time as well, it is time for our conversation to come to an end. It's been so much fun speaking to you, but I mean, the other day you were dragging me that I haven't saved your number. It's saved now. And It's safe now, and we can have many more conversations in the future. So it's the end of this conversation, but it's not the end of our journey together.
Yes, certainly. I mean, I still think that you and I should have. I will be better at this the second half of this year than before. We need to have more kind of educational conversations on either a Twitter platform or IG platform, because I think like kind of the work that you do is really important. But I've been thinking a lot about like, you know, education, like in the marriage sense, but also, I don't know if you know, I read this on Twitter, right? About this lady who's 66, who's fighting a legal battle because her husband kind of divorced her without her consent.
Yes, I saw that.
And I want to have a conversation about that, right? And I want to have an educational thing about that. So I definitely think that you and I, yes, you are right. It's the beginning of a journey. But for us to be more intentional about educational, you already do that on your platform so well. And I want to see how I can plug in in order to make it, you know, a little bit more collaborative. And also maybe you're tired of talking by yourself to have someone in conversation with you.
Perfect. Thank you. Yes. Every time I host a live, I'm always just like to myself, okay, this would go better if it was conversational rather than me being a lecturer. So thank you so much for offering that. I will definitely be in touch with you specifically for that project or for that conversation.
Thank you. Really, it's been wonderful to talk to you. It feels really short, but I'm so glad that you've asked like really profound questions. And again, I wanted to say I'm really honored to be on this incredible podcast, and I wish you absolutely all the best. And also, if you need like anything in relation to support who Black woman you want to talk to, just hit me up and I'll be able to put you right in there.
All right, wonderful. Thank you so much, Lehlogonolo. Enjoy the rest of your week.
You too. Thank you.
Bye.